I'm speaking with Daniel Goleman, and it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks, Steve.
Dan, I want to take you back to your early days mm-hmm. as a psychologist. You got a PhD in psychology from Harvard in the 70s. When did you first get interested in the Buddhist take on how the mind works?
I got very interested in what you would call Buddhist psychology when I was at Harvard. And I had somehow it just dropped out of the sky. One day I found out that the fellowship I had to attend Harvard had a paid-for year-and-a-half traveling fellowship. And I was already interested. This was the 70s, and I was quite interested in Eastern philosophy and Eastern methods. I had started meditating already, as many people in my generation had done. And I had gotten to know a fellow named Ram Dass, who, as Richard Alpert, had been fired from the very department I was getting my doctorate in at Harvard.
Because of his research with Timothy Leary on LSD.
Yeah, and that was about 5 years before. So it was still echoing in the halls there. But he had gone to India and come back, not as Richard Alpert, but as Ram Dass, and was talking about yoga, which then was very exotic. Meditation, which was practically unheard of, although it was starting to be part of the zeitgeist, and a transformation of being that sounded very interesting to me from a psychological point of view. So I grabbed that fellowship, ran off to India, met his teacher and many others, including a wonderful man named Kunu Rinpoche, who I later learned was the Dalai Lama's instructor on compassion. You can imagine what he was like. And I realized that there was a psychological system at the heart of Buddhism that was absolutely unknown in Western psychology. And I started to write about it and about the way it worked with the mind, the way it conceived of what you could do to transform the mind, and meditation was very much at the heart of that.
What didn't Western psychology understand about this?
Western psychology did not understand, A, that practices like meditation did transform the mind, and now we know the brain. No one had ever heard of the word neuroplasticity in the 1970s, but the idea that repeated experiences change the structure and function of the brain was implicit in Buddhist psychology and unknown in Western psychology. And also the fact that you could transform the mind to the point where, for example, your inner emotional state was not at the whim of external conditions, but was an ongoing, say, equanimous state that was one of kindness. This was inconceivable.
You're saying psychologists in the 1970s didn't even think about this kind of thing?
I would say psychologies in the 2010s don't think about it that
really?
Much as a whole, although it's getting to be a more and more familiar idea, yes.
So to pick up the story of your own journey, you were a doctoral student getting your PhD at
that's
Harvard.
That's right.
Then you discovered all the stuff about Buddhism.
Well, what I discovered was an alternate psychological system. It's called Abhidharma, which is the Sanskrit term for this model of mind. And I started writing about it in psychology journals, albeit very obscure psychology journals, because they were the only ones that were interested. And I felt that it was important to bring this news to Western psychology, because what it did was extend the horizon line of the potential of being human. And, if psychology is about anything, it's about the mind and what are its upper limits, what are, the worst places we can go, what are the best places we can go. And this describes some best places that we hadn't heard of yet. They weren't on the itinerary.
Did you get pushback from the academics you were working
with? I got push out in that when I returned to Harvard, I did my dissertation on meditation and stress. That was okay because it was physiological. And I showed that if you meditated, you would recover more quickly from stress, say later in the day. And then I went back. I had a postdoc, and I went back to Asia and did more intensive studies of Abhidhamma, came back to Harvard as a visiting lecturer, taught a course on the psychology of consciousness, which was hugely popular. It was so popular, they had to move it into the biggest lecture hall at Harvard. And then my contract was done, and and there was nowhere to go in psychology at that time, because this is where I was, my interests were, where my heart was. And, you know, it was a time when most departments were rather Skinnerian. They're studying pigeons and rats and mazes and so on. And there was literally no job in psychology that fit my interests. Luckily, I was able to segue into journalism, and I became a science journalist.
Mm-hmm. And you wrote for the New York Times for years.
Well, I started at a magazine called Psychology Today, which then was a major magazine, and segued to the Times, where I was in the writing for the Tuesday Science section, basically, for about 12 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, your first book, published in 1977, was called The Varieties of Meditative Experience, and it would seem that the title was an obvious takeoff on the classic William James book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. And I'm wondering if you saw, maybe still see, meditation as kind of the contemporary version of what William James talked about as religious experience.
Well, William James was extremely interested in mysticism and altered states, essentially. He experimented with nitrous oxide. There was a big fad around the turn of the early 20th century. And he saw that, as he put it, that he said something like, reality is not necessarily best understood at a temperature of 98.6 Fahrenheit. What he was saying was the neural correlates with which we receive information can shift as brain function shifts, or at least he speculated that. And he did a rather good job of tracking the various maps of altered realities that the mysticism of his day presented. When I went to Asia, when I went to India, I was very interested in meditation as a pathway to transformation of being, and that did include some experiences of altered states. And it was really confusing. TM had come to America. It was very popular.
Well, Transcendental meditation.
What is TM? Well, it turns out TM is a classic, in a sense, a classic mantra meditation. It comes out of a long Hindu tradition. But there were Sufis. Well, what are Sufis? Well, you know, they're the mystics of Islam, and they have their own meditations. And then there was a guy named Gurdjieff, who was very popular at one time. He was a mysterious Russian mystic who taught a method which turned out to be very similar to something called Vipassana, or mindfulness meditation. And I was trying to sort it out for myself. So I was reading all of these various traditions and mapping similarities and differences across traditions, and that became the template for the book, The Varieties of the Meditative Experience. And I also threw in this Buddhist psychology, or rather Reader's Digest simplified version.
Well, I mean, what I find so fascinating by what you're saying is that you're talking about these various Eastern spiritual traditions, but you come out of an academic training of psychology, Western psychology. So the obvious question is, what's the connection there? And is this modern interest in the science of mindfulness, does it have a spiritual component?
Well, first of all, I use the lens of, we would say now, cognitive psychology. I defined meditation as a retraining of attention and looked at the different attentional strategies that you could work at training. I think that holds up, actually, from a psychological point of view. But these were embedded within spiritual traditions, every one of them. And even though the belief systems differed, very often the fundamentals were quite the same. So you could see a second century Christian ascetic in the desert of Egypt as doing pretty much what a yogi in a cave in India, in the Himalayas, was doing, and even using the same basic technology.
Even though the metaphysical system is very different. I mean, for one thing, those early Christians talked about God and Buddhists don't.
Exactly. However, if you look at what they're actually doing, you know, the Christian would be using a set of rosary beads, and each time with each bead, he'd be saying Kyrie eleison. That was his mantra. It's Greek. And it still goes on in the island of Athos. There are thousands of people still doing this practice very seriously. But if you go to the Himalayas, you've got a yogi in a cave, and he's using what he calls a mala, which is the same technology, and he's saying Om Namah Shivaya. But I think that the impact at the level of brain and at the level of training focused attention is one and the same.
Hmm. Does it matter to you to bring to make this connection between ancient spiritual traditions and modern psychology, modern brain science, or is your focus more on the science itself and, you know, maybe we don't have to talk about that spiritual stuff?
Well, I feel that bringing the methodologies that have been tried and perfected over millennia now to the attention of Western science is extremely important because it turns out that those technologies do something that we're only now learning from a scientific point of view is possible, which is to retrain the brain and to do it in a very beneficial way. The fact that it comes within a belief system is not as relevant to science, except, you know, from a scientific point of view, you might say, well, what's the impact of that belief system as an add-on? However, you know, over the years, we haven't talked about this, but I became very involved with an organization called the Mind and Life Institute.
Which is associated with the Dalai Lama.
Yeah, the Dalai Lama was a co-founder, and one of the main activities has been to organize conferences between scientists and the Dalai Lama, who's extremely interested in science and pretty smart about it, as many scientists learn, very sophisticated. But you know, through tutorials and self-taught. But at one of these meetings, he said, this was a meeting that I had organized on destructive emotions. He said to the scientists, who included some very eminent emotions researchers like Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin, Paul Ekman, world famous for his work on facial expression of emotion and so on, he said, Buddhism has many techniques for managing destructive emotions effectively. I'd like to see them taken outside the religious context, studied rigorously, and if they prove to be of general benefit, spread widely, not as religion, not as Buddhism, but as something people can do to help with the suffering in their own lives. Hmm. And that triggered a whole program, which is being vigorously pursued now, on what are the beneficial effects of these methods, these ancient methods, but ancient methods within a modern context.
Well, it's worth pointing out that for a lot of people in the modern Western world, secular people, Buddhism is very attractive. I mean, it seems, for people who sort of can't buy into perhaps the religious faith that they grew up with, it would seem that sort of, I don't know, to put it bluntly, Buddhism is sort of, you know, the religion for atheists.
I guess it can be that because Buddhism doesn't posit a god. So you can be an atheist and a Buddhist very comfortably. Sam Harris, a famous atheist, does Buddhist practice, for example. He's a guy I know. So I think also Buddhism has a certain attraction for intellectuals in this era because Buddha said, you know, don't take my word for it. Try it yourself. You don't have to buy into a belief system in order to practice it and see if there are any benefits. So I think that is also probably a plus in this day and age.
Do you still meditate?
I meditate every day.
What do you find most valuable from your own contemplative practice?
Well, I'm a writer, and I find that if I meditate, well, here's my morning ritual, so to speak. Get up, have some coffee. My wife and I have breakfast, and then I meditate. She meditates. I meditate. And then after I meditate, I find I'm very calm, very clear, and writing comes most easily. So there's a very practical payoff. I'd say also that the more I meditate, the more I like the guy I turn out to be.
So, I mean, that's so interesting what you're saying. I mean, it sounds like, for you at least, meditating helps your creativity.
I think meditation helps creativity very directly. I have a book coming out in October called Focus. It's about attention. And one of the kinds of attention I talk about is a kind of open awareness that facilitates creativity. And it does it in this way. Creativity essentially is the bringing together of two elements that were not associated before in a useful, fresh way. That's the creative act. Mm-hmm. Some define it that way. And those elements are floating around in our mind somewhere. And it's only when we are in a mode of attention where we can notice them coming together and that, hey, that's pretty interesting, do we get a creative insight. And I think meditation puts you there.
Hmm. Do we know what's happening at the neural level to enhance that? I mean, to facilitate those creative insights?
Well, we know some brain correlates of creative states. You can see the same brain patterns on people when they're, say, solving a word puzzle and they get that insight. They get this flash and gamma waves are involved in different parts of the brain and so on. You also interestingly see the same configuration in rappers while they're doing a riff. Hmm. So you don't have to be in a meditative state. You can be really on and also in that same creative state.
Hmm. Is it accessing particular parts of the brain that we ordinarily don't have access to?
I don't think it's accessing parts of the brain. I think it's accessing functions of the brain that we usually don't have easy access to. And it's because when we're distracted, when we're running around, when we're going through our to-do list, when we're focusing, when we're constantly being interrupted by emails and phone calls and texts and or letting ourselves be interrupted by going online and browsing, whatever, we're in a state where we're preoccupied. We're lost in our own stuff. And in a creative state, you need to be somewhere else. You need to be open to what's going on. You need to be quiet. You need to listen. You need to be attentive in a certain way, not in an effortful way, in a very relaxed way. This is why the history of science is rife with instances of someone solving a complex math problem, going for a long walk, coming up with a big breakthrough while taking a shower. Because you're in a kind of a reverie state, and that facilitates the creative act. Mm.
Do you think it's accessing something in, I guess, what we would call the unconscious? Is that what's going on here?
Well, it's accessing what we call the cognitive unconscious. The cognitive unconscious is not the Freudian unconscious. The Freudian unconscious is a really storm-tossed place full of libido and id and impulse and angst and so on. The cognitive unconscious is simply what we don't ordinarily have access to in the mind. It's the backstage of the mind. But the cognitive unconscious knows a lot more than the conscious. There's an optical illusion of mind where we think that what's within our awareness is what's going on in the mind. Actually, it's less than 1%. It's a tiny fraction of what the mind knows, what it processes, what it takes in, what it perceives. And most of what we do is actually done unconsciously. However, if we can get a window on that, we have access to a wider range of what we know. And when we have access to that wider range, we can put together more far-flung elements, more disparate parts, and come up with that one creative insight.
Hmm. Now, you are probably best known for your book, Emotional Intelligence, which has gone on to sell millions of copies. How did you get interested in this subject?
Well, I'm a clinical psychologist by training, and that's really someone who works with emotions all the time, although I did go into journalism. So I was covering what they called the decade of the brain in the mid-90s, and the National Institute of Health had given a lot of money to brain research, and very interesting findings were coming out, and I'm covering this. And in the Times, you can write, in those days, you could write an article up to 2,000 words. Now it's, I think, 800, which is a story in itself, yeah. but another story. I realized that there was a bigger story here and that I really wanted to write a book about the new science of emotion in the brain, that this was very new and exciting, had lots of implications for our everyday lives. And I happened to, since my job was basically to harvest academic writing, I would read technical journals and then translate them for everybody in the Times. I stumbled across an article that had the title Emotional Intelligence. And I thought, wow, that is a powerful concept. Sounds like an oxymoron, but it means we can be intelligent about emotions. It's written by a guy, a friend of mine, Peter Salovey, who's now the president of Yale University. He was a psychologist at Yale then, and his, a graduate student, John Mayer. And I took that concept and used it as a frame for a book on emotions writ large.
So what's the difference between emotional intelligence and the more classic way we talk about intelligence as measured by IQ?
Well, IQ, which is, of course, extraordinarily important, is academic intelligence. It's verbal abilities, it's math abilities, it's spatial reasoning. It's the kind of smarts that helps you get through school and do very, very well. But it turns out that once you get into the workplace, that kind of intelligence predicts powerfully what job you can hold. You need an IQ of one standard deviation or so above average, 115 to 120, say, to be a professional, to be a doctor, to be a nurse, to be a teacher, to be a top executive. But once you're in those roles, IQ isn't a powerful predictor anymore of who will be successful within that discipline, or at the top ranks of a company. It turns out that how you handle yourself and how you handle your relationships is a more powerful predictor of who, for example, will emerge as a leader. And that defines emotional intelligence, how we manage ourselves, our self-awareness, our empathy, our ability to collaborate and negotiate and so on.
So basically, this is about being good with other people.
Indeed.
Is that your phone that just went off?
That was my phone. I'm so sorry. How embarrassing. But luckily, since we're...
Yes.
You can edit that out. Let me get rid of my phone.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Where were we?
So I was saying... So this is about being good with other people.
Emotional. Being good with other people is part of it. Being good with yourself is another part. Being able to manage to get done what you have to do, to have fun, to be spontaneous, to be focused. All of that has to do with self-discipline, but that's part of emotional intelligence too.
Now, you said that emotional intelligence is key to good leadership. Is that widely acknowledged among, corporations, the business world, the academic world, that top leaders should have a high degree of emotional intelligence?
It is more and more, and I'm rather surprised. When I wrote the book Emotional Intelligence, I had one thin chapter called Managing with Heart. And on the basis of that, I went on to write another book, which was Working with Emotional Intelligence, about workplace benefits of being emotionally intelligent and for leadership. And the Harvard Business Review asked me to write an article on emotional intelligence and leadership called What Makes a Leader? That was in 98. It is still one of their most requested reprints. Hmm. And that's because companies and organizations are buying it in bulk to pass out to people.
So what are the essential qualities to a great leader?
I would say from an emotional intelligence point of view, the essential qualities of a great leader have to do with self-awareness and using that as a, for example, an ethical rudder. Is what we're doing or where we're going in keeping with our sense of purpose, values, meaning, our mission? You can't know that without self-awareness. I would say that managing yourself well is absolutely essential for a leader.
What do you mean, managing yourself?
Well, emotions are very unruly. However, there's a set of emotions that help people work at their best. And leaders have a privileged position and a tough position emotionally in an organization. And it's this. In any human group, people pay most attention to and put most importance on what the most powerful person in that group says and does. That makes the leader the emotional sender. And there's a series of experiments that have been done mostly at the Yale School of Management where people in a working group, a leader, is put in a bad mood and then goes into the group. And everyone in the group catches the mood and performance goes down. The leader's put into a good mood. People catch the good mood. Performance goes up. So there's an optimal internal state for performance. It's called flow sometimes. There's whole literature on that. And it has to do with feeling good, being energized, being enthused, being motivated. And people work at their best. Well, you could say once you understand that, then the leader's emotional role becomes helping other people get and stay in their best state. Well, you can't do that unless your own emotions are under control. You've got to come into work in that state, or you've got to, you know, radiate it out in some way, implicitly, not in a clunky way, like, hey, don't we feel great here?
You're really talking about the capacity to inspire and what goes into that.
Yeah, and inspire in the root sense of the word, to breathe in, to there's a brain-to-brain bridge. Social neuroscience has discovered this, where emotions become highly contagious. And they, as I said, they tend to flow from the most powerful person outward. So you're inspiring by your being.
Is there an ethical dimension to what we've been talking about here, whether it's emotional intelligence, whether it's meditative practice? I mean, it's one thing to know yourself, but to do that, does that... Is there an intrinsic connection to doing good?
Well, I think that the ethical sense comes from being in touch with your own feelings. Does this feel right? Does it not feel right? We put that into words, why it feels right. That's where our ethics really come from. But that needs to then go out to the group and then to be aligned with what the organization is doing. That's what leaders do. In part, at least at the ethical level, is make sure that what we're doing is in keeping with what we believe.
Do you think there is something about us as human beings, something about the human brain that is, I don't know, hardwired so that we have a natural impulse to act ethically?
Well, there is some literature that suggests that we naturally want to collaborate. However, and that we have a felt sense intuitively of fairness, for example. People get really outraged when they feel they're not being treated fairly. And that's a very universal sense. So there's some universal moral dimensions that people tend to follow. Yes, I do believe that. And however, I think that they can get corrupted, they can get abused, and... It's very interesting, for example, in terms of compassion and kindness, that the neuroscience is now telling us that that's a combination of feeling the other person's pain, which is an immediate emotional sense, and then a cognitive operation, which is, do I care about that person? Do I value that person? Which then determines whether you'll want to help.
Well, one of the reasons why I ask this is one of the criticisms of the sort of the Western fascination with meditative practice is, I mean, there's this sense that it's all about me. You know, it's like, you know, I go in and I, you know, I become a more whole person. But I mean, the question then is, does that also radiate out to make the larger community better?
Well, luckily, there is good evidence that as people become more secure, as people become more equanimous, as people become less anxious, they tend to become kinder. You are, as you become less self-absorbed, less caught up in your inner melodramas, you have more attention to pay to the people around you. You can tune in better. You can empathize more. And it's only then can you go the next step, which is compassion.
What's your sense as to how... our new online world is affecting these kinds of things that we've been talking about as more and more people are looking at screens, you know, browsing the web, you know, being on Facebook, Twitter, what have you. Is that changing our brains in any meaningful way?
Well, I have a couple hunches. It's a huge unplanned experiment with, you know, entire generations. But on the one hand, I think collectively it makes us smarter. We have easier access to more information, and we can crowdsource. We can do all kinds of things. We have big data. We have maps of the world that we never had before. So cognitively, there are clear benefits. Emotionally, I'm really worried about kids. I'm worried about a generation which is spending more time staring at a screen than it is relating to other people, particularly as it pertains to emotional intelligence, because we learn this in life. We learn from our parents, who are our first mentors, our first coaches in emotional intelligence. We learn from hanging out with other kids. We learn from play. Play is a huge arena for learning how to be a human being. And I think kids are doing it less. I feel they're trapped in this virtual world. And because of that, I'm a very strong advocate of teaching these lessons in school along with the others, because I think there will be a skill deficit that could have serious consequences if we don't.
I want to end with a hypothetical question. Suppose the President of the United States were to come to you, Dan Goleman, and say, okay, I'm going to make you happiness czar of this country. You will be in charge of government policies to boost the well-being of all Americans. First of all, is that an absurd idea that government policies could do anything like this? Or if it's
I think the absurd idea is that he'd come to me in the first place. and that the government would do that. However, there is a school of economics which is emerging, which says that our measure of success, pure economic productivity, misses the point. We should be looking at how happy and satisfied and fulfilled. We should look at well-being as a monitor of how well a nation is doing. How would we bump up well-being?
Exactly.
How would we get more points? How would we beat Denmark?
Or maybe it's Bhutan. I don't know. Oh, Denmark is the happiest country
in the
world?
So they say. I think, you know, a multi-pronged attack. First of all, you can't ignore the gap between rich and poor. That's a fundamental unfairness. And I think we have to do something about that, whatever it is. We can't ignore basic human needs, health care, food. I think we need to give that. It's not as though we can just give a pill to people, make them happy, and not care about the very hard realities of the poor in this country. So that's fundamental. And then over and above that, you know, there's a literature that suggests that once people get basic human needs, there's no relationship between money and happiness. Because it has to do with what's going on in your life, what's going on in your mind. And so the next thing would be to help people with their minds. And meditation certainly would help. Emotional intelligence, social emotional learning is what we call the program in school. And it helps kids know why they're feeling and what they're feeling, what to do about it.
Do you think it would be a good idea to try to have this part of a standard school curriculum?
It is part.
Teach emotional intelligence?
Oh, yeah. It's being done in tens of thousands of schools with many different names. There are hundreds of programs now that help kids do this, and it integrates very well with a program. I would add to that mindfulness. This is a newer wrinkle. Mindfulness is a method, a particular kind of meditation that helps kids, for example, gain more executive function or cognitive control. This is the ability to manage your impulse, your anxiety, and so on. And it's fundamental to doing well in life. It turns out to be a predictor over and above IQ, over and above the wealth of your family of origin. So I think there's a host of things we could do. And if you'll get the president to give me a call, I'll tell him exactly what I think, Steve.
If the president calls me, I will pass that on. Thank you very much.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks.
That was great. Thanks.
Yeah, you're great. That makes it so easy. That's cool.
Anyway, thank you. What a pleasure.